I like that hymn. That's a good one. Now, with that great introduction, we'll ask our brother Dan to come forward and bring the words of exhortation. His topic is... Nope, that's the lecture topic. I'm sorry. Let me get the right topic. Be strong and of good courage. That makes more sense.
Well, good morning, my beloved brothers and sisters. And thank you very much for the hospitality this weekend. I thoroughly enjoyed seeing so many people that I've met before and also meeting so many of you that I had not had the privilege of meeting. It's that constant reminder just how great and wonderful and large our family truly is, that we can find that that fellowship no matter where we are across this world. So we're going to open to Deuteronomy 31 as we continue in this story of Joshua's development, his education, his growth from this servant to the leader of the nation of Israel as they enter into the promised land throughout the book of Joshua. As we come to Deuteronomy 31, we're at the end of the wilderness wanderings. We were 40 years in. Moses is talking about passing over a torch, over the command, as it were, to Joshua. And he gives this last speech to the nation, well, to Joshua, but also to all the people. And he says there in verse 2 of Deuteronomy 31, and he says that I am 120 years old this day, and I can no more go out and come in. Also, Yahweh has said unto me, thou shalt not go over this Jordan. So we remember back to our earlier studies about this phrase, the idea of going out and in among the people. And Moses is telling us his time of leadership, his responsibility was coming to a close, and he was handing it over to Joshua. And there's a story there, and there's an event that literally happened. But as we've done all weekend, we're looking at the types and principles that God has laid for us. And we know that Moses is a type of our Lord Jesus Christ. We see in Moses, we know that Moses appears there at the Transfiguration to encourage Christ. But Moses' responsibility, his, what he's trying to teach us, the principle and the type, is Christ at his first ministry, as he brings us through the land, or through the wilderness into the promise, at the doors of the promised land. And it's Joshua that carries on that work as a further type, representing Christ's return, as he comes as a king to lead us into the kingdom, to fill the earth with God's glory. And this is that sort of passing over of these two dispensations or two responsibilities of Christ. The first seen in Moses and the second we will see in Joshua. And then we see there in verse 10, it further points us towards this change, this conclusion of God's purpose. We see in verse 10 that Moses commanded them when? At the end of every 7 years. So as he's telling them this story of Joshua regaining or giving control of the nation, he also reminds them about this other law or this other ritual they were supposed to uphold. And he tells them at the end of every 7 years, in the solemnity of the year of release, in the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel has come to appear before Yahweh thy God, in the place he shall choose, thou shalt read this law before all Israel in their hearing. So we're talking about the completion of that 7 year period, or that 7 day period we have in Genesis chapter 1, or the 7,000 year period that we see all throughout Scripture. It's again reminding us of this process that God has for us, that it comes and it will come to a conclusion. It's not an ongoing thing, as long as it might appear to be at sometimes, but the process does have an end. At the end of that 7 year, in the Feast of Tabernacles that we talked about a little bit this morning. It's at that moment in verse 12 that to gather all the people together, men, women, children, and the strangers that are within thy gates, everyone comes to this moment. We're all invited, brothers and sisters, that we might hear, that we might learn and fear Yahweh our God, and observe to do all the words of this law, and that the children which have not known anything, they might hear, and they might learn to fear Yahweh your God, as long as you live in the land, whether you go to Jordan to possess it. So they were given this constant reminder that they have to learn to fear Yahweh, that they be instructed in all the words of his law, or this book that we have, that we share together this morning. And there's that emphasis there, isn't there, on children, that they might be taught, that they might learn, and that they might fear our God. So it's on that stage, on this reminder, that Moses declares these things to the people. And he gives a series of encouragements, first to Joshua, but really to all the people. And we see them there in verse 6. There's three things he says. Be strong and of good courage. Fear not, nor be dismayed, because God will not fail you nor forsake you. So these encouraging words are given to Joshua as he's about to take on this amazing work, this huge responsibility for the entire ecclesia. Why? Why does God take the time to encourage Joshua? Well, if you come down to verse 16 and 17, in the same moment that Moses is encouraging Joshua to be strong, to not be afraid, Yahweh also says to Moses, as Joshua is standing by in verse 16, behold, thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, and this people will rise up and go a-whoring after the gods of the strange of the land, where they go in to be among them, and they will forsake me. They will break my covenant which I have made with them, and then in my anger shall be kindled against them, and in that day I will forsake them. I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall befall them. So they will say in that day, are not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us? Could you imagine, you're about to take over this huge responsibility. It's your job to shepherd in the ecclesia, or maybe it's at work, you're taking over this huge job to run the business. And as you're given your introduction speech, your boss says to you, once I give you the reins, it's all going to fall apart. That's when you need encouragement. That's when you need to be reminded that you have a God that's not going to fail you or forsake you. These are the words that Joshua is given right at the beginning of his ministry. And we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that he takes those words to heart. That those words actually do impact his next 40 years. Or 30 years, I guess. And they change how he does things. Because when we come to the end of Joshua, in Joshua 24, as he gives his final speech, his last words to the nation, it says in Joshua 24 and verse 31 that Israel served Yahweh all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua and which had known all the works of Yahweh that he had done for Israel. See, those events that we talk about here in Deuteronomy 31, they didn't come to pass in Joshua's days. Joshua remained strong. He led with conviction. He united the people in their service to God. Those things came after. After Joshua died and the elders passed away. We go to the time of the judges, that the people began to fail and to forsake Yahweh. God gives us these kind of encouragements, brothers and sisters, so that they can impact us. They can motivate us. They can excite us, remind us that God is with us to help us in these things. So we see these three, really four different words of encouragement that Joshua is given. Now, in verse 6 of Deuteronomy 31, be strong and of good courage, fear not nor be dismayed, he'll not fail you nor forsake you. Now, really there's four sort of statements made, because that idea of fear not nor be afraid is repeated in verse 8, but the language changes just a little bit. It says, fear not nor be dismayed. And slightly different words and different impact, but really the same idea, this encouragement not to worry about what goes on around you. I mean, we're told to fear Yahweh, right? We saw that in verses 12 and 13. So when he's saying to Joshua, fear not nor be afraid, what he's talking about is the things that go on around you, your interactions with the world, the Canaanites, your brothers and sisters at times, your family. Don't be afraid of those things. Don't allow those things to get you down. Because I will not fail thee nor forsake thee. Let me just want to look at a couple words from this encouragement. We'll start with the word fear. Now, we talk a lot about the idea that we aren't to be afraid of the world around us, but we are to fear our God. We are told to fear Yahweh. Again, in verse 12, that you may learn and fear Yahweh your God. That word fear, and we talk, it's a fairly common word in the Bible, and we often will translate it as reverence. Revere, reverence our God. And that is 100% true. We need to revere our God. But it's also true that this idea of a fear of Yahweh, there's a bit of the other kind of fear as well. Of that healthy fear of respect for your Father. And what he can do. And what he's about in his power and his authority. But there's another aspect to this fear. And we talked a little bit about it yesterday. The word fear, the word yare in Hebrew, it means to flow like water. It was the same word we looked at yesterday in Exodus 30:24, right? When it's about to teach them the words of the law, it's the same idea. If you think about it, if you are afraid of something, you do come a bit like watery jelly, right? Your knees start to crumble and you can't really stand up. You become like water and you just fall flat. Fear has that effect on us, right? That's why people use, in the world around us, fear, right? They use fear tactics to teach and mold people. Because when we're afraid, we become moldable and shapeable. So when we're told to fear Yahweh, it's because we need to be shaped by his hand. And there's this connection. We saw it there in verses 12 and 13. Even in, turn over to Psalm 25. Another example of when we have this connection between fear and teachableness. In Psalm 25, in verse 12. What man is he that feareth Yahweh? Him shall he teach in the way he shall choose. The fear of Yahweh is the beginning of wisdom. What God is trying to get us to understand is that we shouldn't fear the world around us. In other words, we shouldn't allow that dispensation, that culture, society, belief system to shape us, to mold us. Rather, we should fear Yahweh and allow him to have that effect on us. Just in the same way that our God worked in the life of his son, morning by morning, day after day, he woke his son, teaching him the truth, teaching him how to respond, to speak a word in season, to know how to deal with the challenges and the difficulties of his flesh. God did that for his son, and that fear was developed. So Joshua is being encouraged not to be afraid, not to be shaped by the world around him, but rather to be shaped by the hand of his father. And then he's told to be strong and have a good courage. That word there, strong, means to grab hold of something. God is asking us to grab hold of him. Don't let go. And that's the first phrase, isn't it? Be strong and have good courage. Grab hold of me. Why? Because if you grab hold of me, you're not going to be afraid of the world. And if you grab hold of me, I'm not going to forsake you. Because the word forsake means the exact opposite. It means to let go. So if we are grabbing hold to our God and the things of the truth through our brothers and sisters, God is not going to let go of us. He's not going to loosen the ties that bind us to him. We saw in verse 16, it's not God that forsaked. They forsook God. They let go of him. Then God's response to that is that he lets go of us. But it's not initiated by God. God's desire isn't that he lets go of anybody. He wants us to hold fast to him. But we have that choice of how we want to do things, of what we want to do with that opportunity. And if we hold fast to him, he will never let us go. But if we let him go, if we walk away from him, then he will give us exactly what we asked for. And he will let go and let us go. And the beautiful thing is he'll be there waiting when we return. But we have to return. We have to choose to go back. There's moments in our lives we go through that process where we're holding fast to the truth and we're behaving in a way that is pleasing in His sight, and then we let go and we stumble, we trip, we fall. In those moments of despair when we are stumbling away from our God, have faith that He's waiting for us to come back. He wants, He desires, His hand is outstretched just waiting for us to grab hold of it. He has no desire to push us away. That's our choice. So Joshua was given this encouragement, this focus of how he can be a leader and how he can be an example. And these phrases appear all throughout Scripture, especially the first two, be strong and of good courage, fear not nor be afraid. We see them repeated earlier in Deuteronomy, chapters 1 and 2. We see them in Joshua. We see them in the New Testament. But there's only two other places in the Bible where all three of these phrases appear together. Three other times when that encouragement is necessary, it's needed. And the first is over in 1 Chronicles 28. And in 1 Chronicles 28, we have another moment of transition. A transition, again, like Moses to Joshua, points forward to Christ's work on the cross and His work as a coming king. In 1 Chronicles 28, we have David passing on the leadership to his son Solomon. So in 1 Chronicles 28 and at verse 20, David says to Solomon his son, be strong and of a good courage. Do it. Fear not nor be dismayed, for Yahweh your God, even my God, will be with thee. He will not fail thee nor forsake thee until you have finished all the work in the service of the house of Yahweh. You see these same words, these same encouragement. You can imagine David thinking back to the law, thinking back to what God had said to Joshua, and knowing that Solomon needed the same encouragement, just as you and I need this same encouragement, just as Christ needs that same encouragement as He went on to do the further work for His Father. And the other time we see it is again to Joshua in Joshua chapter 1. So as Joshua, Moses has passed away, he stands there looking out over the promised land, knowing what he had to do and the enormity of the challenge before him. And God comes to him again. It starts in verse 5. He says to him in verse 5 of Joshua 1, just as with Moses, I'll be with you. I will not fail you nor forsake you. Verse 6, be strong and of a good courage. Verse 7, be strong and courageous. Verse 9, have not I commanded you to be strong and of a good courage? Be not afraid, neither be dismayed. For Yahweh our God is with thee, whithersoever you goest. And again, finally in verse 18, at the very end of the chapter, whosoever he be that doth rebel against my commands and will not hearken unto my words, and all that he commandeth them, be put to death. Only be strong and of a good courage. So again, we have these three phrases of encouragement given to Joshua to remind him that God would be with him if he would just hold on to God. He gives him another encouraging word in Joshua 1 in verse 3. He tells them there that in every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, that have I given to you, just like I told Moses. So again, Joshua is further reminded of things, of encouraging words that God has said to Moses. He says, everywhere, every place that you walk on, that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, I will give to you. Take courage in that, Joshua. And if we think about that language, this idea of our feet trotting upon something, and our minds are making the connections in Scripture, and we're reminded of the things that God has told us about, and our minds go back, don't they, to Genesis chapter 3. And that moment in the garden where Adam and Eve are given a choice, whether to hold on, to grab God, to hold on to Him, or to reach out and grab something else, as they did in that moment of temptation and trial when they grabbed the fruit. But as God delivered the judgment upon Adam and Eve, He also gave them a hope, doesn't He? He gave them a hope of a promised seed whose foot would overcome, would tread down the serpent. That's the work of our Joshua, of our Messiah, that everywhere where his foot walks will be overcome. We see that in a national sense in this world as Christ will come with the armies of God and overcome the armies of man. But as we're reminded in the bread and the wine this morning, we see it also on a very personal level. When he stamps on the head of that serpent, when he overcomes the thinking of the flesh. Just come over to that moment in Mark chapter 15. So it's Christ on the cross, as he, the culmination of that work that he had done every day of his life, because we know it wasn't just on the cross that the flesh is stamped out. It was every day, every moment where he chose God's righteousness over the sins of the flesh, he was stamping on the head of that serpent. But it culminates here on the cross in Mark 15. In front of all of us, to remind us, to be an ensign, a banner for us to see. And we read there in verse 33 of Mark 15. And when the sixth hour was come, and there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with that loud voice, and he said, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which is being interpreted, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? That's language back from Deuteronomy 31, brothers and sisters. And we know in this moment, Christ was quoting Psalm 22. As we turn back to Psalm 22, trying to understand what did Christ mean on the cross in that moment. As he was overcoming the flesh, as he was choosing to hold on to God, he chose God's way every moment and every opportunity that he had. But he's quoting those few words from Psalm 21, or Psalm 22, sorry, verse 1. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why does Christ say those things? That word forsaken is the same word that we read back in Deuteronomy 31, to let go. When God says to Joshua in Deuteronomy 31, I will never fail thee nor forsake thee. When God tells them that I only forsake you once you forsake me, in verses 16 and 17 of Deuteronomy 31. So why does Christ say that now? Why does Christ on the cross make mention of these words in Psalm 22? If we go through the psalm, we see time and time again all these connections to these moments of his death. In verse 7, their laughter and their mockery of him on the cross. We see, as we go down in verses 11 and 12, they surrounded him like the bulls of Bashan, the roaring mouths of the lion in verse 13. In verse 14, his bones are poured out like water, the pain, the agony he was suffering. Verse 16, they pierced my hands and my feet. Verse 18, they take my garments among them and they cast lots for my vesture. As Christ was quoting those words in Psalm 22, he was going through that whole psalm. He was recognizing that the events that God had said would happen were all happening exactly how they were said. But that means if he was going through Psalm 22 in his mind, then he came to verse 24. For he hath not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, neither hath he hid his face from him. But when he cried, he heard. That's the conclusion of the psalm. It's that God heard him. That he answers him. There's going to be moments in our lives, like there was there for Christ, where we're not sure what's going on. Because we don't know all the ways that God is working in our lives. When we ask you, God, why? Why are you forsaking me? When we ask a question, you can ask a question to challenge somebody. And you can be challenging in your question. Or you can ask a question with a desire to understand. And that's the tenor of the question here in Psalm 22. That should be the tenor of the question that we ask God. You know, what's going on? Why are these things happening? And God is bringing us to the same conclusions. That even though we might not understand in the moment what is happening, we can have complete faith that if we haven't let go of God, there's no way He let go of us. And Christ does come to that realization at the end. But I think the question still needs to be asked, why did He feel that way in that moment? Why does He say and ask the question? What is He seeking to understand in that moment? Because he knew that his God was with him. Well, I think there's a pattern. God had spent Christ's entire life teaching him, building that relationship of father and a son. So that when Christ was faced with challenges, he would choose the way of his father. But come over just for a moment to 2 Chronicles 32. So in 2 Chronicles 32, we have the story of Hezekiah. He was a faithful king. A king that God had worked with and inspired and encouraged. And we come down to verse 30 of Hezekiah, of 2 Chronicles 32. It says there that this same Hezekiah, he stopped the upper water courses of Gihon. He brought it straight down to the west side of the city of David. He prospered in all of his works. Howbeit, in the business of the ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, who sent unto him to inquire of the wonder that was done in the land, God left him. That's our same word for forsake in Psalm 22 and in Deuteronomy 31. God left him. Well, why? It wasn't that Hezekiah had left God necessarily, but God left him for a purpose. God left him to try him, that he might know all that was in his heart. Now, when Hezekiah was faced with that trial in that moment, he failed. Right? His pride puffed him up and he bragged about all the things that he accomplished in the land. In the same way that Adam and Eve, in their moment, when God allowed them to face that challenge and that trial, they failed. As we talked earlier, it's not that God put those situations before Adam and Eve and before Hezekiah so they would fail. He did it so that they had a chance to declare his righteousness, to make the right choice, to validate all the education and the teaching that God had provided for them. The same is true for Christ on the cross. It's interesting, we're told in Mark 15:33 that when he says those words, it was at the end of the sixth hour, very specifically when the darkness was lifted. Again, God gives us these details. He's telling us a story. So why did it matter the darkness was lifted? Well, let's go to another Psalm, Psalm 18. And God talks about that darkness being lifted. Psalm 18, again, we're talking about Christ's crucifixion. We see there in verse 4 of Psalm 18, the sorrows of death have compassed me, and the floods of ungodly men have made me afraid. The sorrows of hell compassed me about, and the snares of death prevented me. So we're talking about the same sort of situation. These are psalms that point forward to Christ's work. Come down to verse 9 of Psalm 18. He bowed the heavens also when he came down, and darkness was under his feet. So God came down in the darkness. He rode upon the cherub. He did fly, yea, he did fly upon the wings of the wind. He made darkness his secret place. His pavilion round about him were dark waters and thick clouds of the skies. Darkness was over all the face of the earth at that point. In the middle of the day, it was dark. Because God had descended to his son. Verse 12. At the brightness that was before him, the thick clouds passed. It was dark, but yet there was brightness. That reminds us, doesn't it, of Moses again. When they came to the Red Sea, and there was that cloud, and darkness was there, and the Egyptians were in darkness. But Israel was in light. Because God was working with Israel, not with Egypt. I think this psalm suggests to us that as it was dark for that time on the cross, it wasn't dark for Christ. They didn't understand what was going on. They didn't see what God was showing his son. In those moments of agony, like fierce physical pain and struggle, that God was right there beside him. Christ could see. There was, I'd imagine, an angel. Probably the same angel that had been with him his whole life. The same angel that woke him up every day and repeated the words of his father to him. That same angel was there in the darkness, giving Christ a light to strengthen him, just as he had strengthened him the night before in the garden, and encouraged him that God could be with him, as he'd encouraged him his whole life, as that father taught his son every day how to choose the right, how to walk in righteousness. And it would seem as that darkness lifted, and Christ asked the question, what had changed at that moment? It seemed that the angel lifted with the darkness. And it would be different for Christ. It'd be almost a new experience. Where is the angel? God, where are you? And he asked the question, trying to understand. But he was reminded so very quickly that God was there. Because Christ never let go. He knew without a shadow of a doubt that God was still around him. Just because the angel wasn't there did not mean his father wasn't all around him. But God was giving Christ that final trial, that final moment. It's almost like you think about a father teaching his child day after day, maybe how to ride a bike. And you teach your kid and you're kind of grabbing them on the sides and you start small. But there becomes that moment where you need to just move your hands away and let that child ride the bike. It's almost how that is for Christ in this moment. Christ taught him every day how to stay committed and stay on the right path and to know that God's will was my will. And so when Christ had that moment on the cross and he didn't flounder, he didn't falter in his step and his commitment to the righteousness of God, because God had so perfectly instructed his son. In that moment, he continued on in that path. Yes, he had a momentary wonder of, no, God's here. And that's how it should be for each and every one of us. In those moments when we're not sure where God is, because we can't see the angel beside us. But that does not remove the angel from being there. It doesn't remove our Father's hands from just guiding us, just right there. Come over to Hebrews chapter 13. In this example of Christ on the cross and how his father instructed him to choose the right way, to not grasp at something that he wasn't meant to take in the way that Adam and Eve did. It was a perfect instruction, and he was a perfect son. And he was there on that cross, overcoming the flesh, putting it to death, pouring out his life for us, as an example. These memorials aren't just meant to be something that we take day by day, rehearsing a pattern. They're meant to be alive. They're meant to find life in us. And so in Hebrews 13 and verse 5, it says there that let your conversation or let your conduct, your character, be without covetousness and be content with such thing as you have. For he hath said, I will never leave thee, nor forsake thee. That's the same language. That's the same Greek word that we saw on the cross. We're reminded time and time again that God will not leave us nor forsake us. Verse 6, why? So we might boldly say that the Lord is my helper. That word helper is the same word we saw in Mark 15 for the cry of Christ. God will answer that cry. Because it says there, I will not fear what man will do unto me. We shouldn't fear what man can do, because God is there to help. Verse 7, remember them which have the rule over you, who have spoken unto you the word of God, whose faith follow. The word follow means to imitate, to mime. We are meant to imitate this example. We are meant to follow the example of Christ, the author and the finisher of our faith. Whose faith follow, considering the end of their conversation. That word end is only used twice in the Bible. It has the idea of the origin of your walk. Where does our walk come from? The only other place we see that particular word is in 1 Corinthians 10. That God would always give us a means of escape. Let's just turn over quickly. Leave your finger in Hebrews 13. But come over to 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13. As God talks about trial to us here. Verse 13 of 1 Corinthians 10. There hath no temptation taken you as such as common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that which you are able, but with the temptation also make a way to escape, that you might be able to bear it. Now, if I'm still bearing it, I haven't really escaped it. It's still there. It's not the idea of escaping from that moment. It's the idea of providing you a way to choose right. In every moment, God has given you an example, a way to walk. It's Christ. Christ is always there to show us how we should respond to trials and temptations in our lives. God hasn't left us without instruction. God hasn't left us without a roadmap or a pattern to follow. In every moment of our lives, we have an example and a pattern. Verse 7 again of Hebrews 13. Whose faith follow, considering the end or the walk or the example of their conversation? That word conversation is not the same, by the way, as the word conversation in verse 5. This word means conversion. We see it in Matthew 18. And verse 3, where it says, be converted. Except I say unto you, except you be converted and become as little children, you shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. And whosoever shall humble himself as a little child, the same is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Why does God use the example of children? Because children follow their parents. Children are humble. They're moldable. They're teachable, brothers and sisters. The older we get, unfortunately, the more stubborn we become, the more stuck in our ways. You can't teach old dogs new tricks, as they're saying that we use so often. So God tells us, don't be like that. Be like a child. I'm your father, he says. I can teach you. I can shape you into a beautiful thing. But we have to be humble enough to accept it. We have to be humble enough to imitate our Lord Jesus Christ. So back in Hebrews 13, who is the end of our conversation? Who is the end of our conversion, our turning back? Verse 8, it's Jesus Christ. The same yesterday, today, and forever. It doesn't change. He's always been this way. Just like God, who is and was and is to come. Christ is the same as his Father. He is our example. In the bread and the wine. The same yesterday and today and forever. Hebrews 3 and 6 says, but as Christ is as a son over his own house, whose house are we if we hold fast the confidence and rejoicing in the hope firm until the end. Brothers and sisters, we have been given an example to grab hold of. As we take the bread and the wine, it shouldn't be a momentary thing. It's not just about this morning. We're meant to grab hold of that every day of our lives. Every time we come to those moments of trial, If we're holding fast to Christ, to God, then we will declare God is right in those moments. We will ride as he has instructed us to ride. And we can do it in the knowledge that our Father is always hovering around us to catch us, to help us stand back up, to instruct us in a way that is life eternal. So just as we see in the emblems, the culmination of a life poured out in service, of the crucifixion, the putting to death of that flesh, let us do the same thing every day of our lives in putting to death our sinful nature by pouring out our lives in service to God.